Well, welcome to this session here on the Gospel of Mark. This is the 15th session, and this is about the end times. We're going to be looking at Mark chapter 13, which is a very unique section in the Gospel. Now, Mark chapter 13 serves as a kind of like a prophetic warning and a discipleship manual. It bridges what has happened previously with the confrontation in the temple with what is going to ensue later on in the passion narrative with Jesus' arrest, trial, and crucifixion. What this section is going to do is talk about the end times, but in the context of some historical matters that the disciples bring up and question Jesus about. And so what Jesus is going to share is going to be aimed at helping his disciples understand the ensuing persecution and the false teachers and the suffering that they are going to experience. And it kind of reorients the influence of the temple and everything that Jesus had condemned previously in Mark chapter 12 with the destruction that the disciples asked Jesus about, with then the ongoing nature of the hardships and the tribulation ultimately in the end time with his return. So let's begin looking at Mark chapter 13. The various sections break down like this, that there's a prediction of the temple's destruction. Then Jesus talks about the signs of the beginning, and then the abomination of desolation and the tribulation, the coming Son of Man, the parable of the fig tree, and the parable of the watchman. So Mark chapter 13, verse 1, it says, "And as he went out of the temple, one of his disciples said to Jesus, Teacher, look, what magnificent stones and what magnificent buildings. And Jesus said to him, Do you see these large buildings? There will absolutely not be one stone on top of another left here that will not be thrown down." This initial question by the disciples, they're leaving the temple right after Jesus had his third entry into it at the end of chapter 12. And the disciples are admiring the temple and just its beauty and its grandeur. And it was a very impressive structure for anyone in the ancient world. But the disciples are asking about Jesus, sort of like, do you see this temple? Do you see this place? And they were just in there moments earlier, and Jesus was not impressed with it. And so Jesus here gives a prophecy. He's predicting the destruction of the temple. He says there's not going to be one stone left on top of another that will not be thrown down. Now, he might be echoing here a prophecy of Haggai, which was about putting one stone on top of the other. And this is kind of a reversal of that. But what he's essentially saying is this temple, it's going down. It's going to collapse. It's going to be destroyed. There will not be anything left of it. So the next section starts in verse 3. And they're moving away from the temple here. That's the setting. And it says, "And as he, Jesus, sat on the Mount of Olives across from the temple." So they're leaving the temple complex and they go to the Mount of Olives, which is nearby. And it's across from the temple, directly eastward. "And Peter, James, and John, and Andrew asked him privately." So Jesus and his disciples move away from the temple, and four of them, Peter, James, John, and Andrew, which are the four first apostles or disciples that Jesus called from beside the Sea of Galilee, these four ask him privately. So they're now secluded. They're not with crowds. They're by themselves on the Mount of Olives. Now, the Mount of Olives is over here, directly east from the temple, across from the Kidron Valley. There's actually three different tops to the Mount of Olives. They call them the first, second, and third summit. And up here on the third summit, there's a vantage point to look, and you can see across here to the temple complex. This is modern day Jerusalem. And in the foreground here, there's like a Jewish cemetery. But this is on the third summit of the Mount of Olives, looking across at the temple complex. And to just kind of see a better perspective from a more aerial point of view, this is the temple complex, which is the larger courts. And then the inner temple would be there with the sanctuary, which no longer stands because it was destroyed, which we will talk about momentarily. But that's where they're at. They're on the Mount of Olives, and Jesus, it says, sat down. which is a common expression for somebody who's either going to be teaching or who's going to be rendering judgment. We'll see which one it is. So they're at the top of the Mount of Olives, and his disciples, verse 4, they say, "Tell us, when will these things be? And what will be the sign when all these things are about to be accomplished?" So Jesus just told them about the destruction of the temple, and his disciples are like, "Well, tell us, what's going to be the sign, and when are these things going to happen?" So verse 5, Jesus began to say to them. So Jesus is teaching here. Watch out. This is going to be a kind of a common theme. Watch out so that no one leads you astray. Many will come in my name saying, "I am he," meaning I am the Christ. I am the Messiah, and will lead many astray. And when you hear wars nearby and reports of wars far away, do not be alarmed. These things must come to pass. But Jesus says the end is not yet. For group will rise up against group and kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes in various places. There will be famines. These things, he says, they're not the end. He says they are the beginning of birth pains. This is the beginning of birth pains. Jesus now is connecting the destruction of the temple with wars and earthquakes and groups rising up and fighting against other groups. And all these trials are, you could call them signs, but they're not the signs of the end. These are just the beginning. You could say that they're the things that are the labor pains associated with childbirth. And this is what Jesus is trying to say, that there's these wars, earthquakes, persecutions. These are all going to be things that the disciples and Jesus's followers will experience. And there's nothing sort of like unexpected about them. It's not as though Jesus is telling them, "Oh no, watch out. These things are going to happen that you didn't think are going to happen." He's just telling them that as the world has gone about in this way, has gone awry, this is going to be what will continue. And all it is just a precursor to the end. This setup here is going to begin the series of statements about being alert, or as we read here, watch out, beware, be on the lookout. The Greek word can mean all these. It just means to like be attentive. And it's going to begin this motif of being alert and also to be enduring through all of these trials and suffering. And this predictions of the things to come are foretelling of all the hardships that not just the disciples, but all of Jesus's followers should expect to see happening. And here with this kind of like little private instruction session that Jesus and his disciples are having, he is telling them to be on the alert or be on the lookout so that they are not taken by surprise. And that's why in verse 9, he follows up with, "Well, but be on your guard, because they will hand you over to the courts, and you will be beaten in the synagogues, and you will stand before governors and kings because of me as a witness to them. And the good news must first be proclaimed to all the nations. And when they arrest you and hand you over, do not be anxious beforehand about what you will say, but say whatever is given to you in that hour, because it is not you who is speaking, but the Holy Spirit." This gets personal now. It's not just things that are happening in the world. Jesus now focuses in on what his disciples can expect to experience personally in the future, that they're going to be apprehended. They're going to be handed over in law courts, and they're going to be beaten in the synagogues, and they're going to be brought before kings and governors, not in an honorary sense, but in a sense of having to give an explanation or a testimony. And it's going to be because of Jesus, he says. Because of me, they're going to be brought before kings and governors to give a testimony, to give a witness. And he puts this verse 10 here. And the good news must first be proclaimed to all the nations. It's as though Jesus is giving this sort of precursor to the larger expansion of the kingdom mission to the Gentile nations. And he gives a little word of comfort here in verse 11. He says, when they arrest you and hand you over, do not be anxious. Now, I can see the disciples hearing Jesus tell them, you're going to be arrested and handed over, but don't be anxious. I think anybody who gets arrested is probably going to have a little apprehension or a little anxiety about what's going to happen to them, but Jesus tells them to be at peace. They are not going to be left without help. And what they're going to say in front of these governors and kings is not just going to be something that they come up with in their mind as a clever way to try to work in the situation. This is going to be the Spirit of God. Here, the Holy Spirit, it's going to be God's Spirit in them, helping them to give a witness or give a testimony about Jesus the Messiah. They're going to receive the words that they can then speak and utter in front of these prominent individuals. But further than that, and more than that, in verse 12, and brother will hand over brother to death, and a father his child, and children will rise up against parents and cause them to be put to death, and you will be hated by everyone because of my name. But the one who endures to the end will be saved. It goes from a social context, and Jesus even kind of sharpens the incoming suffering that's going to happen, to being familial, brother against brother, father against child, and people will be put to death because of what family will do, and everyone will hate you. So Jesus comes down with the final punchline that the whole world, even your own family, will hate you because of me. But the encouragement he gives is you need to endure. The one who endures to the end, or the one who endures through it, will be saved. This then segues into probably the most complicated section here of this chapter, the abomination of desolation and tribulation. So Jesus segues into this by saying, but when you see the abomination of desolation standing where he should not be, and then Mark adds this, let the reader understand, this little narrative comment, then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains, and the one who is on the housetop must not come down or go inside or to take anything out of his house. And the one who is in the field must not turn back to take his outer garment. But how terrible it will be for those who are pregnant or for those who are nursing mothers in those days. And pray that it does not happen in the winter. Now, this phrase here at the beginning, when you see the abomination of desolation, this is a reference to the prophet Daniel, who uses this term about at least three specific times, this abomination of desolation, which Jesus here is not giving any particular identity to, but it is something that is against the order of the Jewish temple complex. It's an abomination. It's sacrilegious. It's something that's abhorrent. It's something completely ungodly. And it's an abomination of desolation, which is an abomination that causes desolation, is probably a better way to understand that. Meaning that whatever this sacrilegious, whatever this unholy thing is that is going to be happening, it is going to cause the place to become desolate. Meaning it's going to cause it to cease its normal function. It's not going to be, the temple is not going to be a house of worship any longer. It's going to be changed. It's going to be done away with. Now, Mark offers this little side comment to let the reader understand. And I think what he's doing is trying to give people context that there needs to be some discernment here with what follows. The first thing that Jesus says is that there's going to be a problem for people in Judea. If you're in Judea, whenever this abomination of desolation happens, which we'll talk about potentially what that refers to, then the people in Judea should flee. Mainly the people in Jerusalem and the surrounding areas should flee to the mountains. And then he gives a series of additional warnings that people who are maybe up on the rooftop shouldn't go back down inside. They should exit on some type of external staircase or something. Or somebody who's in the field working, who has taken off their robe and is working maybe their tunic or something, that they're not supposed to go back for their outer garment. And then for the women who are either pregnant or are nursing, it's going to be tough no matter what, he says. And then pray that it does not happen in the winter, which likely could refer to unfavorable climate conditions, but probably more importantly, in the Palestine of that time, the winter season being the rainy season, the wadis would just be flooded and filled, and it would cause travel to be very difficult because of blockage due to the flooding. Now, Jesus continues on, verse 19, because in those days there will be tribulation. This word tribulation just means hardship, adversity. Now, it's not just general tribulation. He says there will be a tribulation unlike anything that has happened from the beginning of creation. This is going to be a unique event, he says, and that God created until now, up until this point, he's saying, when it occurs. And it will absolutely not happen again. And unless the Lord had shortened the days, meaning shortened how long the tribulation occurred, no flesh would be saved, meaning no person would be left alive. No person would be left living. This is not a salvation. This is sort of who would survive, essentially. No one would survive if God did not shorten the days. But he shortened the days for the sake of the chosen, for the sake of his people, whom he chose. So let's pause there for a second. This reference here to the abomination of desolation and the tribulation that is unique, unlike anything that has happened before, there have been a number of interpretations trying to make sense of what this is referring to. And there's really three main kind of perspectives. One is that this refers to some type of historical event within the first century. There are a number of different things that happened in the first century AD, right after the time of Jesus and in the time of the early church. It can also refer to the Roman Empire and the Roman army. And then it could refer to some type of eschatological future event. Now, there are pros and cons for seeing what's going on here from two perspectives. If it's talking about something in the first century that the disciples were to witness, then it would be something that has to deal with the temple, Jerusalem, something with that's going on with the Jewish religious services and rituals within the temple complex. If it's referring to some futuristic eschatological or end time event, then this is all just sort of setting up some unknown event in the future by which the reader would then be able to recognize that this is the abomination of desolation. The advantage of looking at something that's historical is that Jesus talks here in historical terms, for example, like in verse 14. He talks in historical terms that people in Judea will recognize this event, this abomination of desolation. And when they recognize this event, they're supposed to act. The idea of this geographical locale being in around Jerusalem and Judea, it favors the idea that it's some historical thing that happens there that those people are going to be affected by. And then later on, we'll see that Jesus talks about the things he's saying, that this generation that he is speaking them to, that this refers to Jesus' contemporaries. It's difficult, as we will see, for the interpretation of that phrase if it's some unknown future event. Thirdly, that there are multiple events in the first century that kind of align with these wars, these false messiahs, the persecutions, the famines, everything that Jesus is talking about. And there are historical records of ancient writers, particularly like Josephus, who talk about the widespread unrest and the false prophets and the destruction and suffering that happened under the Jewish-Roman War and the ultimate destruction of the temple in AD 70. Lastly, Jesus frequently warned of judgment that was coming, as we read in Mark chapter 12 and beforehand when he was in the temple, that there's judgment coming upon the temple, and which that would be seen to be fulfilled in AD 70. And so this judgment that would happen on this generation seems most fitting to occur in a historical setting that his disciples would live to see and recognize. Now, there are some difficulties. For example, there's a lot of apocalyptic language we will see coming in the next section that doesn't seem to square with a historical view. So this is the advantage of a futuristic view, is that there's language of eschatological contexts from other parts in the Bible that it seems Jesus is drawing on here, particularly the association of the prophet Daniel with the Son of Man coming in the clouds. as we'll read about in verse 26. And further, we definitely will get down into a time of the future of unknown reckoning. Whenever this will occur, Jesus says, nobody knows, not the angels, not himself as the Son, only the Father knows. Clearly, that's a futuristic reference of some type of unknown future global kind of event that would be more plausible than a sort of like a local geographical event, such as the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem in AD 70. And also the routine call for Jesus' disciples to be on the lookout, to kind of like watch out or beware or pay attention to. This seems to correlate then with the looking forward to the return of Christ and the looking forward to and seeing the Son of Man coming in the clouds. So let's continue reading here and we'll see these things unfold more in the next section. Let's go into verse 24 to 27 where it talks about the coming of the Son of Man. So Jesus continues saying, but in those days after that tribulation, so there's a tribulation period and this is going to be subsequent to that. Jesus now draws on these heavily eschatological themes and terminology here from the Old Testament. He says that the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light and the stars will fall from heaven and the powers that are in the heavens will be shaken. And then they will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory. Verse 27, and then he will send out the angels and will gather together his chosen ones from the four winds, from the farthest end of the earth to the farthest end of heaven. Jesus pulls here from several references in the Old Testament about the end times. So it seems that if Jesus does have some historical perspective going on in the beginning, he has transitioned here to clearly an eschatological or end time perspective. And this is most apparent in verse 27, when after that tribulation time, these cosmic portents or these cosmic signs occur, the heavens will be shaken, which can be a figurative reference to just some kind of cataclysmic event that they, he doesn't tell his disciples, you will see. He says, they will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory. And then after the Son of Man comes, then he will send out the angels and will gather together his chosen ones from the four winds, from the farthest ends of both earth and heaven. This type of harvest or the type of like going out to reap the harvest of the field is an eschatological imagery that refers to the ingathering of God's people at the end of the age. And for the angels to be doing this, it seems that there's really no good explanation that Mark is trying to have this be purely historically based. As Jesus is teaching here, he seems to clearly be pointing to some future event that is going to be clearly the end time where God is going to sum up all things and bring together his people. And this is going to be done through his angelic messengers, not some historical reference in the first century AD. However, it's hard to square just a simple futuristic reference only with the geographical specificity that Jesus began the whole section with. And so there are a number of scholars, and I tend to seem to lean in that direction myself, that this solves some of the complexities, some of the tensions with the either or view of it being historical only or futuristic only. A lot of times there are references to a dual fulfillment. For example, the reference in Daniel to the abomination of desolation is very likely referring to an event that happened in the second century before Christ. The Seleucid ruler, Antiochus Epiphanes, in 167 BC, there is a record of this in the book of 1 Maccabees, which is an apocryphal book, that really kind of like shows it to be likely the fulfillment of that prophecy. In 1 Maccabees, it says, on the 15th day of Shislev, in the 145th year, which is the year 167 BC, they erected a desolating sacrilege on the altar of burnt offering that is in the temple there. They also built altars in the surrounding towns of Judah and offered incense at the doors of the houses and in the streets. The books of the law that they found were torn to pieces and burned with fire. Anyone found possessing the book of the covenant or anyone who adhered to the law was condemned to death by decree of the king. They kept using violence against Israel, against those who were found month after month in the towns. On the 25th day of the month, they offered sacrifice on the altar that was on top of the altar of burnt offering. Furthermore, as Josephus records in his Antiquities of the Jews, that Antiochus, or Antiochus, whichever pronunciation you prefer, that they built a pagan altar on top of God's altar in the temple and sacrificed pigs on it. Clearly an abomination. And by doing this, everything that happened prevented the Jewish people from worshiping God in the temple. It was an act of desolation. Now, that had a fulfillment potentially in the second century BC, but it seems Jesus here sees that there's another fulfillment of it in the future. And we know clearly from like the Apostle Paul's writing in the 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 that he thinks there's definitely a future fulfillment of that abomination of desolation as well. So there's a thing called double fulfillment or dual fulfillment, where a prophecy can have a proximal fulfillment and then kind of like an ultimate or a future fulfillment. And I think that this is kind of what may be happening with Jesus's teaching here, what's often called the Olivet Discourse, because he's doing this from on top of the Mount of Olives, that it has this sort of dual fulfillment, where something is talked about in a proximal sense, such as the destruction of the temple, which would be an abomination of desolation that would cause people in Judea to flee, but then mixing that with a long-term, or you could say end-time, ultimate fulfillment at the end of the age. Now, during the invasion of the Romans and the Jewish temple destruction, Josephus notes that 1,100,000 citizens or inhabitants died during the siege of Jerusalem, and 97,000 were taken captive. Now, these numbers might be exaggerated, but he also talks of just about how extreme the conditions were, about the infighting that was happening, the murders, the famines, the disease, and the cannibalism. And so he's really painting a really grim picture, which could suffice some of the imagery that Jesus is talking about here. But kind of like the eschatological overtones, the imagery that's used, that's drawn from the Old Testament, clearly points to there being some reference in the end times as well. So there is this historical immediacy in which some of what Jesus says might be applicable, such as the destruction of the temple in AD 70. But ultimately, there needs to be some long-term kind of view toward the end of the age in which all these things kind of finalize and come about with the destruction, the temple being just a prelude to that, where in the end here, when you have the coming of the Son of Man, and the angels being sent out to gather God's chosen ones from all around the planet. This is kind of like the four winds is like a merism, a polar merism, where it's like from east to west, from north to south. This goes far beyond any local setting in Jerusalem and Judea. This is a global event, which would be something that would coincide with the end of the age and the consummation of all things under Christ and the kingdom. Jesus then moves to kind of teach two principles using two parables. The first one is the fig tree. He says, now learn this parable from the fig tree. And this is going to relate to what he just said. As soon as its branch becomes tender and it sprouts its leaves, you know that summer is near. Likewise, you also, when you see these things coming to pass, know that he is near, right at the door. Truly, I say to you, this generation will absolutely not pass away until all these things have happened. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will absolutely not pass away. So fig tree loses its leaves in the wintertime and then rebuds them in the spring. It's known as an indicator of the coming summer in the area of Palestine. And so Jesus is saying, as a fig tree has its tender sprouts and leaves, you know that summer is there. It's an indication that summer is approaching, which is why he says that you know that these things coming to pass, that he is near, or could be it is near as well. Could be the kingdom or the end or something like that. But he is near, right at the door. And so then Jesus says in verse 30 that this generation will not pass away until all these things have happened. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will absolutely not pass away. On the historical view, this phrase, this generation, is readily explainable if it refers to the destruction of the temple in AD 70, because the generation at the time of Jesus would have still been during that time, would see these things happening. So there would be a literal reference to the generation surrounding him. Furthermore, this phrase, this generation, is commonly used in the Gospel of Mark to refer to contemporaries of Jesus. And this last statement, the heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will absolutely not pass away, just is an emphatic statement of Jesus about the significance of his words, that they are more certain than the longevity of heaven and earth, which have an end, but his words do not. The power and significance of them will stand. Now, the second parable is the parable of the watchmen. Now, Jesus says here, using a kind of like a transition, he says, now concerning that day or hour, no one knows. He doesn't specify what that day is. He's just saying that day, that which is likely referring to the day of his coming. No one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. Now he says again, be on guard, which is kind of like the phrase, watch out. Same thing. Be on guard. Watch out. Stay alert. For you do not know when the time is coming. Now he gives this parable. It is like a man going away on a journey who left his house and gave his authority to his servants, assigning to each his own work to do, and commanded the doorkeeper to keep watch. Therefore, keep watch, for you do not know when the master of the house is coming back, whether during the evening watch or the midnight watch or the rooster crowing watch or the morning watch. Otherwise, when he comes unexpectedly, he may find you sleeping. And what I say to you, I say to everyone, keep watch. This parable of the watchman is that there's an owner of a house who goes on a journey and he leaves his servants in charge. And they all have their own job to do, but he tells them that there is a doorkeeper who is supposed to keep watch. Now, why is the doorkeeper supposed to keep watch? Well, he says that they don't know when the master's going to return. It could be any time. He gives like the evening watch, the midnight watch, the rooster crowing watch, the morning watch. He basically gives all the watches, the entire day, essentially, from evening, midnight, and early morning into normal morning. Like the rooster crowing is usually from like midnight to 3 a.m. to the morning watch. Otherwise, if the master comes and nobody's watching, he may find the servants sleeping. Therefore, there needs to be someone at the door who's watching. And not just the doorman, but all the servants are encouraged as well to be ready for the master's return. And so that's why Jesus follows up here to say, everyone, he's referring to everybody who's a servant because he views himself here as the master who will be going away. And this is sort of like a foreshadowing of his resurrection and ascension. He's going to be leaving on a journey, so to say, and will be returning at some point in time, of which nobody knows. Not even Jesus knows, he says. And so that's why he tells everybody to keep watch. Now, this last section here, keeping watch, as we've seen the recurring theme happen over and over again, the parable of the watchman is emphasizing that discipleship for Jesus in these kind of like end times scenarios is about remaining attentive without fear and panic. And this is sort of like Jesus is the person to whom they're to entrust themselves, that he is going to be returning, that the Son of Man, which is his self-identifier, will be coming on the clouds, and he will have the angels gather together, God's chosen people. And so they can trust in Jesus' words and their enduring power. And Jesus' discourse here, the final statement, it kind of like comes down to and climaxes in this repeated motif of keeping watch or staying alert. Faithful, alert living until the end is what Jesus wants his disciples to understand. Not for them to be date speculating about when his return will be, or to try to pin down some chronological timeline that can then tip them off. This parable is about recognizing that nobody knows when that time will be, and therefore every moment needs to be seen as potentially the one leading to his return, and therefore to remain alert and watchful and vigilant. The narrative here shows that what Jesus is looking for is to focus on what is on a need-to-know basis, not a needing-to-know. So that faithful service over curiosity and wanting to know these end-time details, which is what the apostles originally asked Jesus, tell us when this is all going to happen. And Jesus launches into an explanation about the destruction of the temple that seems to segue into and connect with end times fulfillment. And this is going to set the tone now as we prepare to enter into the passion narrative of Jesus's anointing, arrest, trial, and crucifixion. So we'll be looking at that next time on the Gospel of Mark.